It is now my privilege to introduce our main speaker who comes to us from the Unity Group located in Denton. Please welcome Chris N.
My name is Chris Nowak and I'm a drunk.
Hi, Chris.
I've got a God-given dry date of August 9th of 1987. And I want to thank you for asking me to come and speak to you. It's an honor to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's a special privilege to be asked to speak at this group because I owe a lot of my sobriety to this group. My wife sends her regards. She has to get up at 4:30 in the morning, so she's not here tonight with us. And I thank my friend Stacy for coming and supporting me. She's done a lot of that over the years. And just been having a hard time figuring out what I'm going to say and getting started. I've been thinking about a lot of things over the last week, and I thought I knew what I was going to talk about, and today I don't have the slightest idea. But I guess I ought to tell you why it's such a privilege to speak in front of this group. I spoke here, I guess, about almost six years ago, and after the meeting went out with some of the people here, and I got to understand and to hear how this group got started and how a small group of people got together and developed those principles for how this group was going to operate and what its purpose was. And a couple years later, when we decided to start a new group in Denton, I thought of this group. And we borrowed the format for our meeting from the Big Book group, but we took a little bit of the spirit of this group into ours. And before we held our first meeting, we got together, and Stacy was there, and we attempted to establish the principles for our group. You know, sure, every group has a purpose, you know, to carry the message to the alcoholic. But I think a well-structured and purposeful group has a lot more than just that. And we initially started off to be a non-smoking group, and but we wanted more than that for our group, you know. And as a result of that, we have a well-purposeful group that really goes about the business of helping people get sober. And we're it's kind of funny. We have two meetings, and you're welcome at any time. We meet at the First Baptist Church on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 6 p.m. And we're a small little group, but we give to we pay our rent. We give the general service to intergroup, to the district. Take meetings to two treatment centers in the area. We're represented at the district level, and it's getting real bad. We start at 6 o'clock, and if you're not there before 5:10, there's nothing to do. You almost have to break somebody's leg on the way into the room to get to do something to service. I mean, that's the kind of group we have, and that's the same thing that I saw in this group, you know. And it says somewhere in the book about God showing us how to create the fellowship we crave, you know. And I knew immediately when I came to this group that there was something here that I wanted, and try to duplicate it in our own little way up there in Denton. So I'm eternally grateful for this group, and I guess now that means I got to get started. A couple months ago, I was at a a funeral for a dear friend to some of the people in this room. One of my heroes, a very strong member of Al-Anon, Linda Lamphere. And at the something that caught me when one of the preachers was giving his talk about her, he talked about how much she worked at being a good person and understanding people and trying to be helpful and for finding purpose and meaning and understanding to her life. You know, and that's how every one of my heroes has been like that. Probably the three greatest heroes in my life are my father and a guy named Jack Clater and Linda. And I think why those people stand out is because not only did I see them live their life with respect and dignity and kindness and love, but I saw them face death in the same way. And I mean, I remember when Linda first got cancer the first time, and you'd go to the hospital room and she'd end up cheering you up, you know. And it was the same thing this last time. And she had a sense of understanding of herself, a understanding of how much God loved her, and that love overflowed from her out to other people. And she knew exactly where she was going, you know. And I used to think that, you know, you stayed sober for a certain while, and that stuff just automatically came to people. You know, that if you're sober for a while and if you're a lucky one or something, that had some kind of spiritual thing going on inside you, that you could truly live life as a loose garment. And that's not the truth. It's taken me a long time to see that if I'm going to have meaning and happiness and purpose to life, if I'm going to have good relationships with the people around me, that it takes a lot of work. And I wouldn't have known where to get started if it wasn't for the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I came from a good home. I came from a family that loved God and loved us, and they showed that in the way they treated us. And but I don't know, there was something wrong with me. You know, I can remember being a little kid and there'd be a party or something at the house, and everybody'd be having a good time and everything. And, you know, it was all right. But it always seemed like there was something missing, you know. You know, and I'd walk around, you know, thinking, you know, is this it? You know, it's got to be something better than this. And I think I was a twisted person from the get-go. I don't remember this, but it's been told to me. I was about 2.5 years old, and the family was taking a Sunday drive through the country, and my mother and father are pointing at this and that, and look at that, and you see the cows, and I'm sitting in the back seat saying yes, 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 and I was looking out the wrong window. There were no cows where I was looking, and my family found out that I was just about legally blind, you know, and so, you know, here I was 2.5 years old, and I was already lying to make myself feel like I was a part of, you know. I was raised in a good religious home, and like I said, and I don't know if it was my conception of God when I was a kid, if I saw him as Santa Claus or something, I don't know, but it's for some reason, either I asked for something and he didn't produce, or something happened where I, at an early age, came to believe that, yeah, maybe there was a God, but he don't much care for me. And by the time I was 15 or 16 years old, I'd come to the conclusion that God didn't exist and I had proof. There was, both my parents drank, and they drank responsibly and not very often, but we would have wine on Sundays at dinner, and if we were having seafood or something, we might get a little beer or something like that, and it never affected me one way or the other until I was about 6 years old. And I got a cold, and my mother made me a hot toddy, and I can see it as if it was yesterday, you know, the tea, and she had a bottle of rock and rye, and it had the fruit floating in it, and the rock candy and stuff like that, that amber fluid, and it just looked marvelous. You know, and she gave me a little bit of that a couple days in a row, and you know, I didn't get loaded. I didn't feel any kind of immediate change or get a buzz or anything, but it did something for me, because from that day on, I started fixing myself drinks every day, and I did that as long as I could until I got caught. And and when you have two parents that don't drink a lot, it's kind of hard to eventually it runs out. and I got caught, and that curtailed my drinking for a good while. But I would drink anytime I had a chance. We were always stealing beer from each other's parents' basement and stuff like that, and drinking it and stuff. And for my 15th birthday, I got a draft card and a driver's license that said I was 21. And I was home free. And I immediately started blacking out and stuff like that, and having problems wrecking cars. And I was thinking the other day, I got home one night, and it was winter time, and there was about 6 foot of snow on the ground, and they tossed me out of the car. And I remember stumbling around and everything, and then I don't know how long I was out there, but eventually my family parents came out. They heard all the racket and found me crawling around in the bushes looking for the door, you know. And I was blind drunk in a blackout. And I drank like that every chance I got until I turned 18. And I think when I turned 18, that's when I crossed over that line into alcoholism. And because from that day on, I drank every day, except for there was a period, one time where I didn't have anything to drink for 2 days, but I drank every day, and most of the days until a blackout, until I sobered up. And I had problems from the very beginning. I can remember, well, I don't remember actually, but it was around 1970, and I was either on the west side of Cleveland, or I was up in Toronto, and and I was either sitting in this English pub up there in Canada, or I was in this bar in Cleveland that sold shots for 25 cents a shot, and sitting there at the bar with my bud. And he turned around to me and he says, you're washed up. You can't drink anymore. And I agreed with him and bought the next round. And later that night, I either got arrested across town for a DWI, or I got woken out of a blackout in the King Williams Hotel urinating on a stuffed wing chair. I don't remember which one. I kind of missed the 60s, 70s, and most of the 80s because I was drunk most of the time. But I graduated from high school, and I didn't know what to do. I did know that I didn't want to go to Vietnam. And fortunately, I had a high enough draft number that I didn't have to do that. But I went to college because I'd been to school for 18 years, and that's all I knew how to do. And I was scared to death to go out in the world and find my place and everything. And for a long time, I said that I went to college to avoid the draft, but I didn't. I went because at least that was comfortable for me, and I knew I could, or at least I thought I might be able to do it because I didn't do too good in school. I graduated with a 1.9 accumulated bachelor. There were bets that I wouldn't live to see 16, and then they said maybe 17, and when I hit 21, they said I'd probably live forever. And that's the way I live too. I went to college. It took me 6 years to get out. And I worked full time. I worked hard in steel mills and foundries and construction, made a good living and drank every bit of it away. I just wanted to be happy. I mean, that's all I ever wanted to be, was happy, and never could seem to get there. And I always thought that this will make me happy, or if I drive this car, if I'm with this woman, if I work here, if I go there, that if I make this much money, that life will be great. And every time I reached one of those things, you know, it was good for a little while, but then it went sour. And, you know, and I'd always, you know, say, this ain't it either. And I became a pretty despicable person. I would do anything to fulfill my need for immediate gratification. And that meant stealing. If I felt like hitting somebody, I hit them. You know, if I wanted something that belongs to somebody else, I took it. You know, I put the moves on my best friend's wives and girlfriends, and still I'd do anything to change the way I felt. And I had morals, and I was raised properly, but and when I was young, there was a big long list of things that I would never do. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was very few things. And I'd do it the first time, and I'd have a lot of guilt and pain, and then the second or the third time, it just didn't matter anymore, and it was easy. You know, just like going to jail. You know, first time it was embarrassing, and it was scary and everything, but after a while, it didn't, you know, it was nothing. And I guess around 1980, a lot of things happened. I was working as a parole officer up in Cleveland. And I was hooking up my prostitutes with my friends, and, you know, I was dealing drugs, and most of the things that I was doing, had been in jail for, but I felt it was okay for me to do that because, you know, they were stupid, they got caught, or, you know, some flimsy excuse, and I didn't hardly work. In the wintertime, you usually found me in one of the gyms in town shooting hoop, doing pickup basketball games, and in the summertime, I was playing tennis. And Many a time I called in for messages from the corner bar or from the bed because I couldn't get, I had trouble getting out of there in the morning. And life was getting real sticky. I got in this job as a parole officer, and I took my secretary out for Christmas drinks, and she got pregnant. And by the time this was known, I was living with my boss, and she was married to somebody else, and a lot of my friends were dying left and right and getting thrown into prisons and stuff like that. And I got a call from a friend, and he said, you ought to come to Dallas. Things are really booming here. And I thought it was a good idea because I knew, you know, it was just a matter of time when they'd find me under some bridge dead with a couple holes in my head. And besides, my boss really had spent a lot of time down in Texas and wanted to come too. So we packed everything up and moved to, we lived in Arlington for a couple months while we traveled all over the state, and eventually settled in Austin and got jobs and stuff. And pretty soon that romance started getting a little sour. She liked to drink and she liked to party and stuff like that, but not like me. You know, I was kind of on good behavior there for the first year or so. And she got tired of being the designated driver, of being the one that had to worry, you know, who was going to get drive and get arrested, you know, and it was causing other problems in our relationship and stuff. And then in November of 1981, I got a call, and my father had been hit by a drunk driver and was laying in a coma in a hospital. And I flew up to Cleveland. It took me like 14 hours to fly up on some kind of milk run and stuff. And and that was the last time I saw him until he died. And he stayed in a coma for a year. I just could not go and look at him. I couldn't be of any help or service to the rest of my family because I knew that it just as well could have been me as that guy that killed him. And what was a good man like him doing laying in the hospital with his half his head gone in a coma and a piece of dirt like me walking around the earth? And at that, any controls that I had had on my drinking went out the window, and I was on a suicide run or something. And eventually, the lady I moved down here, she threw me out, and we'd been pretty prosperous. We owned a couple houses and stuff like that, and here I am. I've got two houses, and I'm sleeping on somebody's friend's couch, you know, and I did that for about 2 years. And in between there was a couple times when we got together and stuff. And I remember my last drunk Christmas. I was really trying to get in the big house, back in the big house and the big bed, you know, and took her to, we went to this road trip to Colorado. We went all over the place, and I didn't get drunk the whole time. We were gone 2 weeks, and I didn't get drunk one time. I drank a little wine with meals and stuff like that, but I didn't get drunk the whole time, and I was miserable, and so was she, because I couldn't, by this point, I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. And I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And that didn't work. And so I was back out of the house again. And then in the late summer of 1987, life was just getting too tough. I'd known that I had a problem with alcohol for a long time, and for the first time in my life, I tried to do something about it on my own. And I remember getting up every morning saying, today I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink today. And by the end of the day, I always did. I always did. And the delusion that it was still sex and drugs and rock and roll was smashed. I mean, I knew without a doubt that I was drinking because I had to and not because I wanted to or anything. And it's getting harder and harder to get up, to go to work, to earn the buck, to buy the booze. And the alcohol has affected me to where I knew that it was just a matter of time when I'd be unemployable. And that scared me more than anything, because if I couldn't work, I didn't have any money. If I didn't have any money, I didn't have any booze. And I knew that from early on that drunks don't make good thieves. You always get caught because you're half drunk or something when you're doing the crime. And I knew that if I did that, I'd be in jail, you know. I was just a lousy thief because I was a bad drunk. And but I remember it was Aquafest was coming up in Austin, and they had this big party down on Town Lake and everything. And I decided that was a time for new life for me, you know. My problem, I did an inventory of my life, and I realized that by this time I was pretty much a stay-at-home, alone drunk. And I realized, I said, you know, you're not getting out enough, you're not participating in life. Maybe you're a little intellectually stunted, you ought to get a library card, and I was also out of shape, so maybe I ought to join a gym or something like that. And I did join the gym, and I remember going to the club to work out one day, and I was half drunk and real angry. And I pulled out my shoulder, and I couldn't work out for 6 months. You know? And I was going to go to this Aqua Festival and participate. Well, I never made it there. One day it got pretty bad, and I remember I got a friend of mine to drive me up to Georgetown, Texas, and put myself in a hotel, and I was going to figure things out. And I took a legal pad and a pen and a bottle of Jack Daniels with me, and I got drunk, I passed out, and I didn't put a word on the paper, and woke up with a terrible hangover. And but something was different that day, and it was a Sunday. It was a Sunday, and I just sipped that day, and somewhere in the evening, I decided that something that had a change. That life was just too hard. It was just too hard. I'd given it the best shot I could. I've given it the best fight I could, and I lost out. I was a total zero. And I broke into my significant other's house. Well, it was my house, too, but she was living there, and I wasn't. But I broke in, and she was gone. And I remember I parked my car 2 blocks away so she wouldn't know I was there. Fine sound thinking. And 2 o'clock in the morning or something, she came home and found me rolled up in a fetal position under the bed, crying my heart out. And I, for the first time in my life, I told somebody that I couldn't take it anymore, that it was too hard and I needed help. And she agreed to help me. And I remember thinking, well, I ought to go get my car. And so I went and got my truck. Well, it was a truck. I went and got my truck, brought it back to the house, reached under the seat one last time, and took a swig off of that bottle, and that's my last drink. And I guess, you know, I shook it out for 3 or 4 weeks on the couch. She let me come back there and live there. And after a couple of weeks, she suggested that maybe I ought to get some help. And I thought about it, and I thought that was a good idea because something had changed. You know, I mean, I was a daily blackout drinker, and for some reason, you know, I'd gone 3 weeks without a drink, almost 4 weeks without a drink. And I knew that absolutely nothing had changed. There was absolutely nothing different in me. And that I better grab on to whatever this was. And so I started hunting out treatment centers. And I found the one that, and I interviewed them and everything, and I found the one that I thought was good enough to help me and stuff like that. And things were getting real bad at work. I'd wrecked 2 tractor trailers, and I smashed up a pickup, and they were finding beer bottles and whiskey bottles all over the place and asking if I knew where they were coming from. Nope. And I was afraid to ask them for time off to go in treatment. So I decided that I would try to go through outpatient, and I went and talked to the boss, and they agreed to do that. And I found out a couple years later, the counselor that worked on me, he said that he really didn't think that I would make it. He really didn't think I had enough up here to do it. But because of the fact that I'd managed to stay dry for 3 weeks, he was going to give me a shot. And I really needed that outpatient treatment, but the one thing that I got from them is when I was out there looking at all these treatment centers, every one of them said that as a part of their program, you had to go to 3 AA meetings a week. And so I started going to 3 AA meetings. Well, I started going every day to AA meetings. And for me, at that point, it was a stopgap measure until I got the answer from this treatment center, you know. And it didn't take too long for me to figure out that my sobriety was going to come through AA and nothing else. And I'm appreciative and glad that I had the opportunity to go through treatment because I really needed it. I was a really introverted, angry person, and I needed it a lot. And it took me I hear people say that their best day drinking, they wouldn't take their best day drinking over their worst day sober. And I'm going to tell you, if you hang around AA for about 6 months, and only go to meetings, you don't know what hell is. That was the worst period in my life. It was worse than any other time I ever had drinking. To be sober and to have nothing to change the way I felt. And I came in an atheist, and the first thing they started talking about was God. And I almost left AA because I knew that I didn't believe in God, and if that was a requirement for this program, that I was dead meat. But there was an little old guy named Woody Deal, and he said he used to get up at meetings and say, "My name's Woody Deal, and I'm an alcoholic, and I don't believe in any of this God crap, but I go to meetings and I help other alcoholics," and he'd been sober for 4.5 years. And I said that if Woody can do it, maybe I could too. And I did. And eventually things got hard enough, and my everyday was painful enough that I got a sponsor and started working the steps. And I think that pain has motivated me to do everything that I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came pretty close to drinking a lot of times in those first couple of years. And but fortunately for me, and thanks to God's grace, every time I came up to a situation where it was either do this or get drunk, I did what I was told. I prayed to some God I didn't believe in because that's what they told me to do. You know, I went to meetings. And slowly something started to change in me. And I remember, I don't think I had a sponsor yet, but I remember feeling kind of different. And I remember grabbing one of the ladies from the club after a meeting and asking her if I could talk to her. And I started telling her how I was feeling. And she called me a name that I can't repeat here. But she said, that's serenity. What I was feeling was serenity. And it was so foreign and weird to me that I didn't even know that it was a good thing. And she did me a great service. She lived right around the corner from the club, and we went over there, and she got me down on my knees, and we did a third step right then and there. And, you know, I'd been using my unbelief in God for not moving on to the other steps, and the third step was gone, so I had no excuses. I mean, the way they explained it to me is to do the steps, second step, all you got to know is you ain't God. And to do the third step is only to make a decision, and that's to work the remainder of the steps. And so soon after that, I got a sponsor. And within the first year of sobriety, I worked the steps. And I remember thinking... I remember one day waking up and realized that I'd been sober for 6 months, and I not only realized that, but I realized that I wasn't craving a drink, that the obsession had been removed a long time ago, but the fear was what was driving me and keeping me so upset all that time. And then I worked the steps, and after a year, I decided I'd stick around, that life was better enough that it was worth sticking in this AA stuff. And I continued to pray, and I continued to this God I didn't believe and do all these other crazy things that people told me to do. And I was a couple months shy of my second birthday, I started getting real antsy again. And I knew that if things didn't change, that I was going to have to pick up a drink. And I got this tape of this guy, and I couldn't understand. I had a long time before my brain cleared out, but I remembered one thing that he said, and that was, you'll never be cured of your alcoholism, relieved of your alcoholism, unless you know the nature of the disease. And he suggested you start at the preface and read through the first four chapters until you know what it means to be an alcoholic. And I did that for about three or four months. You know, I'd start off at the beginning of the book, and I might read a page, a paragraph, a chapter, or whatever, and I'd read through the fourth chapter, and then I'd start all over again. And after about 3 months of that, I realized that if God didn't exist, I was in deep trouble, that I didn't have a chance in the world of staying sober. And I probably said my first honest prayer. And I knew at that point that there was a God, and that I never had to be alone again. And life could be happy and meaningful. And life, you know, I was on a cloud for a couple years after that. And then I started having those feelings again that there was something missing. And three significant things happened. I was about 4 years sober, and three significant things happened. I quit smoking. My sponsor was having a lot of health problems, and so we started a non-smoking meeting that in my house that is still going today. They're called the Twisted Serpents, and it's kind of a twist on Twisted Servants. And they've actually gotten a couple devil worshippers showing up at their meetings and stuff. But we started this little group, and there was six or eight of us, and we met every week. And we got so close to each other that every one of us knew exactly what the other person was doing, what they were feeling. And I've never felt a fellowship that close, you know, before or after. And then the other thing was I got invited to a home Bible study. And the only reason I really went there is because there's a lot of good-looking single women. Well, no, that's not exactly true. These people had something that I wanted. They had the gleam in the eye, and they were happy, and they were busy, and they had purpose and meaning to their lives and stuff like that. And it was just mostly a bunch of drunks that wanted to learn a little bit about Jesus. And there was no pressure to be saved or born again or nothing. It was just to learn a little bit more about Jesus. And in the course of about a year, I absolutely fell head over heels with Jesus Christ. And that has probably been the biggest change in my sobriety to date. And I have never questioned whether I can be sober the rest of my life. I've never questioned what's going to happen when this world is over with. I've never questioned the love and the grace of God again. And things were pretty good. And at about 9 years sober, I started, I had a job that I was picking up. I lost a couple good jobs and got fired. And I got this job running around the state of Texas, picking up people from prisons and taking them to halfway houses from a safe pee program. And it was a ball. You know, everybody that worked for the company was in recovery, and we drove around, picked up these convicts getting out of jail who were all drunks or addicts, and listened to AA tapes and went to meetings all over and talked about AA and stuff. And that was all great, but the bad part was I wasn't spending much time with my sponsor. And then shortly after that, I moved up here, and I had a sponsorship via email, and that doesn't work for me. I need constant and direct supervision, and it took that experience to know that, you know. And I got up here, and I was lonely, and nobody didn't fit in. Nobody liked me at the group, and I didn't like them. And I got hooked up with a newcomer, and you know, that went well. But it didn't work. But I think that woman was the first person that I was ever able to love unconditionally and to let them go without clawing their back and chasing them all around town and stuff like that. And but life got crazy, and I knew it was crazy, and I finally got myself a sponsor here in Dallas, and he didn't tell me anything, but he demonstrated how to live. And you know, I'd tell him what I was doing, and he said, yeah, and but I saw him active in service, active in his group, and I started to do that stuff too. And in a short time, my sobriety turned around. And then I haven't slacked since. Another result of that failed relationship was I was sick and tired of settling for second best, you know, and taking the easy way out just to gratify myself and to not have to feel alone. And I decided that I wasn't going to do that anymore. And I did a inventory, and I came up with the partner of my dreams, and decided that I was never again going to settle for second best. And it was tough, you know, because there were lots of times when I was lonely and feeling sorry for myself and horny. I mean, you know, and I'm 10 years sober, and I'm 12 years sober, and I'm 13 years sober, and I'm saying, God, when's my turn? I've been a good AA, you know. I see these people coming in, and they're sober for 5 minutes, and they find the person of their dreams, and they live happily ever after. You know, what's wrong with me? And but I stuck to it, it took a couple years, and I finally found the right woman. And I think what was happening was that I had this person that I wanted to be with, and it took me 5 years to become the kind of person that somebody like that would be interested in. You know, that my goals were a lot higher up than I was. And I really needed to become a person that somebody like that would be interested in, and that happened. And we were able to stay celibate until we were married. And I learned that from a guy that used to come to this group, that he was able to do that. And I thought, well, if he can do it, maybe I can do that too. And it was difficult. And we studied the traditions, and we studied the Songs of Solomon, which comes out of the Bible, and it tells you how to pick your partner, how to date, how to fall in love, how to treat each other, how to grow old each other, how to fight fairly, you know. And armed with those kinds of stuff, we forged a relationship, and it was a pretty good one. And we got married. It'll be 2 years in on March the 9th. And I thought I had it made. You know, I'd done all this work, and I'd arrived just like every other time in my life. But the first year of marriage was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I thought being honest and developing a relationship with that person was hard, but living with them daily and being honest and compassionate and a good partner and applying the principles of this program and the traditions in my relationship about the unity of the two of us as one being more important than her and I as individuals. And it's been a crazy, crazy year. And it seems like it gets harder and harder, and I think that's because the through inventories and seeking God's will in my life and direction and everything, I have a better understanding of myself than I ever did, you know. And when I got sober, I thought there was a half dozen things wrong with me, you know, and now there's bushels. I see bushels, and but I know without a doubt that God has the very best for me in store, and it's just a matter of me trusting Him enough and allowing Him to demonstrate His faithfulness in my life. And He does it every time, and I fight it every time too. This faith and, you know, I hear people say you can't have faith and fear in the same place and everything like that. And that's a lie. I can have faith and fear, but what I need is courage. And that's what the heroes in this program have taught me, the courage that despite the fear, despite the worry, the uncertainty, that I can step forward knowing that God will take care of me is the way to live. And I'm about out of words, and I want to thank you for inviting me, and I hope to come back again.
And before we begin participation, I'd like to thank Chris for coming to speak for us tonight.
Yay!
Steve.
Yeah. My name is Steve Dine, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Sobriety date, August 24th, 2001. And thanks, Chris, for coming out to speak for us. And welcome to all our visitors. And I guess it's been a good week this week. You know, I guess the thing I was thinking about just before the meeting was this idea of sponsorship and just the, you know, how much of a God deal it was for me that I came into a group that believes in strong sponsorship, because I know that my MO was to come into AA and look good, get back with the wife, you know, show her I was doing something about my drinking, and then, you know, fade away again. And you know, the idea of getting a sponsor just didn't make sense to me, because that required a lot of courage to go up and ask somebody, hey, will you help me out, you know? And you know, my attitude was, I'm not a people person, and that won't work for me. You know, it might work for some of you guys, but my case is different, and this is why. And I see that a lot now, being in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I see a lot of guys come in, and it always seems like they always pick one thing and say, you know, here's why I'm different, you know? And it seems like if you can get past that, if they're desperate enough and you can get past that, then it seems to go much smoother after that anyway. Again, just this idea of sponsorship. You know, at Tuesday night, we took that meeting out to Wilmer, you know, and you know, when we were talking that night, just to see the guys, you know, afterwards, after we all shared our stories and then started opening it up for questions and answers, we get a guy that jumps out there and, you know, decides he's going to do the same thing we did and just tell his story. And, you know, the family wasn't real, you know, told him, hey, wait a minute, you know, what are you doing? What's your question? And he says, oh, I don't have a question. I was just doing what these guys were doing. I'm sorry. But then he continues on, and he doesn't, and people start laughing, and he gets so mad. And, you know, he just turns bright red and, you know, talks about writing them all up and then, you know, leaves the circle. It was a disaster, you know. And I was like, man, if he only had a sponsor that could tell him, you know, break through his delusion. But, you know, it's easy to see it, you know, for me to see it in somebody else, but I can't see the delusion in myself. And that's, you know, I can guarantee you, for me to work through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and do the things that my sponsor walked me through, I can guarantee I wouldn't have done it that way. You know, I had no clue. For that, I'm very grateful. Thanks.
Chris.
Crispy Cream.
My name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
I've been sober since December 20th, 1988. I was thinking of Cornell. It is a bright spot in the week. For me, I was thinking back as to more of where I came from as far as the treatment center I was in over in Fort Worth. And all the different jails that I went to, you know, Richardson, Plano, Collin County, all these different ones. And, you know, I sat in rooms like what we go to at Cornell. And, you know, guys like us from the Into Action group came out and spoke to me. And, you know, it was like in one ear, right out the other, you know. And I don't know why I've been sober as long as I have, or why I got this deal. When I was a month from my 21st birthday. But, you know, a lot of gratitude comes to mind, because I've seen, you know, guys that, you know, have to go out there and drink for just years and years and years and years and years, you know, wrecked families. And, I mean, just takes for a long time to come in. And I'm glad that it only took me a few short years, you know, and to get in this deal. So thanks.
Rebecca.
Rebecca!
Hi, my name's Rebecca. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rebecca!
Been sober since June 21st of 99.
Boy, I'm like nervous. It's been a while since I've been up here. I had a good week this week. I've been thinking a lot about my program and what I need to do different, what I need to go back to. And, you know, you get into a comfort zone, you know, and you go to meetings that you always go to. And, you know, I think I've recently been feeling like I need something more. You know, I haven't been sponsoring anybody for quite a while. And there's a lot of girls that, you know, around my age at the group that I try to be an example to. And, you know, I watch them and watch what they're doing, and they are doing pretty much exactly what I did when I first got sober, and that's just not drink, you know. And there's nothing I can do but be an example, you know, and hope that they'll reach out. And it's really hard because I want to work with, you know, new people. And every time I work with somebody new, it just lights a fire in me for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't had a lot of that recently, and I do take what opportunities I have, you know, after meetings at Richardson Group to talk to people. But anyway, I just, you know, I love this group here, and a lot of my program and the principles that I live by come from what I learned here. And, you know, I've been through, I guess, like the last 8 months, kind of a new role change and adjustment to life, and it's been a struggle at times working full-time and getting up and going to work and, you know, doing that kind of thing and being responsible and not calling into work and being on time and those types of things that I learned here as well. And I don't know. I just I know that there's things that I need to do to maintain serenity, you know, and to be active in my recovery and not just sit in meetings and listen, you know. And I guess that's why I'm here tonight. You know, I've, for the most part, for a few years, I acted, you know, I acted on emotions and I acted how I felt, you know, and then, you know, as I continued and I worked the program, worked the steps, I didn't have to act the way I felt. And I guess lately I've been noticing that I have gotten back into that again, you know, kind of acting on emotion and feeling. And, you know, I know where that gets me. Self-will run riot, you know. When I get into self-will and running the show, things fall apart pretty quickly. And, you know, life's been good lately, and work is fabulous. I'm blessed to, you know, do the job that I always dreamed of, you know, take care of kids. And there's so many blessings in that that I couldn't have done without Alcoholics Anonymous. And I recently got a sponsor that sponsored me when I was 19, when I was going in and out of the program for a couple of years. And she calls me on my stuff, and it's a good thing. For a while, I had a sponsor just to say I had a sponsor, and that was all she was. Who's your sponsor, Jessica? What do you do? Well, you know, we get together and we talk, you know, and that was about it. And that really just doesn't get me anywhere. It doesn't further my program, you know. And so anyway, I'm glad to be here tonight and glad to see everybody, and that's all I got.
Steve.
I'm Steve Connor. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
Sobriety date is February 16th, 2004. And I've heard some of the guys talking about going out to Cornell this week. It's been the highlight of their week. And Cornell, too, was the highlight of my week because I was released on Monday. So it's been a beautiful week. And I'm glad to get out of there. But it's good to see some of the guys from there. They're still doing good. And for me, it's been an interesting week so far. I've had some things come up already. You know, I've been locked up for the last 13 months in and out of county jails and in Cornell. And immediately now I've been back for about 4 days. And relationships are being a big problem. I had me a little date set up tonight, a little AA date, I thought, tonight. And as you can see, I'm by myself tonight. My sponsor gave me some direction this morning and told me that might not be a good idea since I've only been out for like 4 days. And I should probably concentrate more on my recovery than on women. So that's, I'm taking, you know, I'm at least I can listen to that kind of stuff today, even though I don't want to all the time. It has to come first, and I'm just grateful to be here tonight. Got me to tell me the truth that I've been through that can give me some good direction, because I need it. I'd be lost without people like you and places like this for me to go. I'm just grateful to be here. Thanks for letting me share.
Doug.
Dougie!
Thanks. My name's Doug Gibbs. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
I've been sober since December 27th, 1999. And Chris, I'm looking forward to your talk. And it's good to see Chris and Rebecca, another Pierce High School person, by the way. It's half the room almost. And Steve, you know, that's what fires me up about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's stuff like that. You know, because that meltdown, I was ready to kill this guy sitting next to me going on and on and on and on and on and on. And to watch him get sensitive and just, oh, my God, have a fit, it's just, I need to see that because I forget that's me. Getting mad at the boss or whomever and stomping out. And, you know, to see a guy come from Cornell and come out on a Monday and change his date and you know, to show up twice, you're better than 95% of the guys that came before you. Yeah. You beat the last four guys. They called me sponsor out of that place. And this week I've been doing a lot of writing, and I've gotten some good sponsor direction on some things, and yeah, I've realized that I have taken back almost every aspect of my life, you know, slowly but surely. You talk about that comfort zone. I was in a comfort zone, and I slowly but surely just started taking things back and taking things back and taking things back. And you know, it's amazing how quickly my mode can just be adjusted by getting honest with my sponsor. You know, I'm only as clean as my one secret or whatever I think is a secret. So I am glad to be here. Thank you.
Chris.
I'm Chris McGinnis. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. I've been sober since January 25th of 91. Chris, it's good to see you and looking forward to your talk. It's been a interesting week for me. It's been busy, and I really liked what the new guy had to say, and I just know how important it was for me to, when I got out of a halfway house or anywhere, was to get right into the AA meeting, and a lot of people don't do that, and we drift away real fast right after that, but that's how I stayed sober the last time. I was just jumped right in the middle of AA, and you know, was our anniversary on Sunday, and the ex-wife was right on time, called on our anniversary to discuss everything that she can discuss about child support, let's name it, everything. So, you know, I was so so angry, and at that same time, I got a call from somebody in this program, and it's someone with a lot of years of sobriety, and you know, God works those ways, because you know she has experience with the next wife, and you know, and I was able to act right, and you know, to calm down and to have you know, not act in the way I've acted in the past, and then some alternate plans that maybe we can try when those situations come up. But the good thing is that I've learned principles, and I've got some decisions, some hard decisions to make. And I was thinking how difficult decisions always have been for me. Either I just never get around to making it, or I act on my feelings, like you're talking about. I just act and make a rash decision. And so I'm walking through some people with that, with some direction and a way to do it right, you know. Yeah. And because I think the longer I stay sober, the more I become willing to listen and to follow what the people before me, those that have what I want, you know. And that gets me excited about Alcoholics Anonymous, is to see those people who are really working that program. Like a lot of people, you know, everybody's enthusiastic here, and they're really working that program and living it, and been in the program a long time, and still come to the meetings, and you know, and that just keeps me going. That just keeps me wanting to grow and move forward. So thanks, glad to be here.
Chris.
Chris Hatfield, alcoholic. Sobriety date's February 10, 2003. second time I hit him, about did him in.
And for that, I'm about as grateful as I know how to be. Alcoholism is some sick some sick stuff. It really is. It's cunning. It's very cunning. And the experience I've had in the last 2 days, it shocked me. It really did. There's this little old lady that lives next door to us. She passed away. Valentine's. And I've known her for the 7 years I've been there. Talked to her every day. She'd come outside and come over and get our dog and play with her. And the night before she passed away, I took her some fruit and some hot chocolate and stuff. It was cold outside. And next morning she passed away. And she didn't have any family, and all she has is an older sister. And she's like 80, 87, 88, somewhere around there. And I asked her if me and my other neighbor could help her clean the house out and stuff, help her clean up. And while we're in there cleaning out this house, she knows I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. She's seen me in a suit, and she's asked me where these meetings were and what I do. And I've told her my story. And I really never had an inkling that this lady was an alcoholic. I really didn't. She wouldn't. You'd never known it. She was like grandma that everybody had, the great-grandmother. Anyway, we're in here cleaning out this house, and we start pulling these boxes out from under her bed, and there's just old boxes and sacks, and inside these boxes and sacks, there's tequila bottles, and there's vodka bottles, and there's Thunderbird bottles, and pretty green ones. And I never realized it. I mean, it just stunned me. It really did. And like today, I had a year's sobriety last week, and it still stuns me the way alcoholing is so cunning and baffling. I think I ran through 26 to 32 this morning. I can't remember a thing I read. I mean, that's how alcoholism does the brain. And you drink too much, you lose a little, or maybe more than a little. I think Alcoholics Anonymous for sponsors or someone that is able and willing to tell me what I'm doing wrong and to give me some sort of discipline and correction and accountability for the things I do, and that asks me, what did you do today? What did you read this morning? And thank you.
Mike.
Thanks, Danny. I'm Mike Erickson, alcoholic. Hi, everybody. July 19th, 87 is my sobriety date, and I'm so glad to see my friend Chris here. We usually greet each other. You know, the Bible says, greet your brother with a kiss. It really does say that, and we take that quite literally. Chris always greets me with a big sloppy kiss, and tonight we had to forego that opportunity, so I'm kind of sad. I got a little sickness, and I didn't want to pass it on to him. But I'm glad to see you here. We're in the same class. We're both from the class of 87, and there's not a lot of our class still running around, you know. As a matter of fact, probably if you're, you know, when I got here in 87, there were a lot of new guys. We've got a class of 04, of which you're a part of, you know, and if you stay here any given amount of time, you're going to watch your class members just fall by the wayside. Just going to watch them fall off by the wayside. You're going to watch most of them go that way. And that's Chris talked about it. That's the tragic thing of alcoholism. It never goes away. It never goes away. It stays right here and gets stronger and healthier. I mean, Rebecca talked about it a little bit of how quick it is to let the brain, whatever feeds our peculiar mental twist, you know, lets us just sit back and go, whatever I'm doing is okay. Or better yet, man, this is too much. And, you know, I was in my prayer and meditation, it's been really sticking on me this week of this idea of how clueless I really am about my defects of character, about how little I know about my state, and that I live in this delusion sometimes that I think I'm doing everything that an AA member should be, you know, that I'm really doing what the book says. And I go and I do a little more research and I find out, Jiminy Christmas, man. When was the last time I've done a 10-step inventory? When's the last time I really looked at my defects of character? When's the last time I really looked at where pride was running rampant in my life? When's the last time I really, you know, got back? And what I find is that, man, if I don't have a sponsor, I'm a dead man. Because alcoholism is alive and well in me. It's alive and well. And it's just waiting for that little creek where the weakness is just enough to say, okay, we can do it, and here's how. I can drink this time, and here's how I'm going to do it. Or I can get away with it, and nobody's going to know. And, you know, I'll tell you what, there seems to be a spiritual axiom in my life that what I give, I get back. And I think it's funny it happens to you guys, too. You know, the benefit, I've been working with this guy for a long time, and, you know, he's had some problems in certain areas, and has just struggled with these problems and has not been willing to surrender to it yet. And man, this morning I get the phone call from, you're not going to believe what happened in my life. You know, and it's one of those, ooh, what you sow you reap, huh, buddy? And it made me grateful. You know, it made me grateful first that I'm not him. That's one of the great things about sponsorship. It made me grateful that I am not him. I don't want to be any of the guys I sponsor. Then again, I don't want to be my sponsor. I want to be me. That's all today. That's not a bad way to walk through life. You know, I just want to be me. But I'm grateful for the experience of by sponsoring, what it does is it points out my defects of character. It allows me to see me a little more clearly when I talk to you guys. It allows me to see myself more clearly and more objectively. And then I take those things, because I still watch the mistakes you make and go, gee, many Christmas, I guess I'm doing a little bit of that too. And I end up taking it to my sponsor and clearing, you know, Doug talked about it, clearing it out, living with a clean slate, man. There's no better way to go than living with a clean slate. It's the most peaceful way to live. Just here's me, deepest, darkest sins and everything. What do we do about it? Oh, okay. I'm willing to do whatever you ask me to do. Wow, what a great way to live. It's the freest way to live that I can think of. Okay, what do we do next? My grand sponsor says it all the time. He tells that to new guys. We watch him at the book study. He says, hey, I just got to learn one thing. There's only one question you got to learn. Okay, sponsor, where do we go next? And if you can master that one, wow, it's, you know, it's pretty much a downhill ride from there. So I'm glad to be here with you tonight. Thanks.
Tim.
Thanks, Danny. I'm Tim Moore, alcoholic. And my sobriety is June 14th, 1994. And thanks, Chris, for coming out. Looking forward to hearing you talk. And, boy, just to stay in kind of that same thing, a theme of what Chris and Mike was just talking about, it's the kind of thing that I've seen this week is, you know, the fact that I... Good examples in AA, you know, guys like my sponsor and his sponsor and the guys I've had of me on my sponsorship line. But the thing I've been learning lately this week is just the bad examples. You know, going into meetings and just hearing things, people going down that slippery slope that I've taken so many times. And this is a good one, you know, thinking that just because I've been sober for whatever period of time, that now I have more than two options. You know, now that I have more than two options, either alcoholic death or spiritual life, that just because I've been here a while that I can just not drink. And if you're an alcoholic like me, like Mike just said, over any period of time, I get worse, never better. And that is true, you know, sober or not. And, you know, I've proven to myself time and time again, if I begin thinking this, then I'm running the show again, you know. And so each day has got to be a day when I surrender fresh and start over anew. And I have to keep coming back to meetings to remind myself of this kind of stuff. Because left to my own devices, I do start thinking this way, you know. So I've got to have all the examples and look and see that kind of thing. And the other deal is what, you know, Victor and I were reading in the car on the way down here. This is in chapter 2. It was talking about how, you know, what we think was... A flimsy reed proves to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And it reminded me of when I was new, how I just thought that, you know, this was just something that wasn't really going to work. You know, I didn't really trust that it would work because I thought that I had tried it. And what it proved to be is you know, God speaking through these meetings, you know, God speaking through my sponsor, speaking through the literature, and being able to see it and to hear it finally. But to me, that was just because I was desperate, you know, and I was willing finally to do whatever my sponsor asked of me. And I'm glad to be here. Looking forward to the rest of the meeting.